part two of World Watchers. It's broadcast number 637, February the 20th, 1984. Getting back to this Los Angeles Times story, they're doing articles on Edwin Meese. He owed $483,000. He earns $72,000 a year. He makes now $12,000 more than he came to Washington. Now, this is very important, and if you are listening carefully, I hope most of you listen with pencils. I always get my pencil on a news thing. If not, call later and get the information from me. Get a pencil and write this down. This is important to write to congressmen, whether it's Leon Panetta or your congressman back east or people in Minneapolis or Houston or Oregon or wherever you are. His debt was linked to wealthy Republicans who later received presidential appointments. Now, if he's going to be the attorney general and the hearings start March the 1st, we want to know who. There are names of several people who gave him loans, but then there are names that they will not identify. And because of the links of the Reagan administration, just read the Rebel articles on Paul Axalt and the mafia and Reagan and Frank Sinatra. And, oh, you know, A to Z, you could go down the whole cabinet in the mafia context, and they all fit into that new book on the banking and the Vatican and the politicians. Okay, he earned $72,000 a year, $12,000 more than when he came to D.C., and his debt is linked to these people. The exact amount of his debt is not available now, and what this article said was that the sheer size of his debts, coupled with the fact that he owes the money to persons with direct ties to the current administration, as the attorney general, it would cast doubt on his fitness to serve the nation's as the nation's chief law enforcement officer. The peak of the debts climbed, as I say, in May of 1982. And the mortgages began. He had four mortgages of $273,000. Keep in mind that he wasn't working except for Reagan's reelection from 78 to 80, according to one story. Two home loans, one from the Great American Savings and Loan Company in San Diego, and the other is the San Diego Federal Savings and Loan. It would be good to do research if any of you can pull out articles on these two banks, just like the Johnny Carson Bank, Beverly Hills Bank, was filled with all mafia, Mr. Duran and Jack Catan and the people that started DeLorean Motors and the Johnny Carson gang. It'd be nice to know about the Great American Savings and Loan in San Diego. Remember the C. Arnold Smith disaster with, he was the man of the Lincoln Club that pushed the Richard Nixon presidency. Now, both companies are headed by a man named Gordon Luce. I don't know if he's related to the Luce, Henry Luce of the Vatican or relatives or what, Gordon Luce. And Luce is also the major fundraiser for Ronald Reagan, and he's the alternate to the United States delegate to the United Nations, so he had an appointment by Reagan. Meese went to Washington and bought another home for $150,000 mortgage. In 1981, he had a tax attorney, John R. McKean, M-C, capital K-E-A-N, and McKean arranged two loans for him. I mentioned those on the air a while back, one for $40,000, another for $20,000. And he won't tell where this money came from. He arranged it. That's the word. He arranged the loan on top of the other loans, okay? And it came from a pool of investors, a pool of blood or a pool of investors that they will not identify. And I think we have a right to know who he owes the money to because of the proximity of La Costa, of Modalitz, of the crime syndicate, of Paul Axalt, and the home base of John DeLorean and Pete Wilson. Now, Mr. McKean got an appointment by Ronald Reagan March 3rd, 1982, to the U.S. Postal Service Board of Governors. Now, with Meese as the Attorney General and Mr. McKean in the Postal Service, and knowing all our postal zip codes and letters and changes of addresses, and it's all CIA anyway, Mr. McKean, who gave him that money, is now in the post office. Now, at the time that all this was happening, when he owed the peak of that loan, which he still owes, in June of 82, I got out my calendar and the broadcast that I did of that time period, because there never was a more important week that in all of my research that I could think of, or two or three weeks. This was the time When Ronald Reagan was in London, he came home in June. Alexander Haig was fired. The Pope went down to Argentina. The Pope went to Geneva, Switzerland. Mr. Raymond Donovan went to Switzerland, the Secretary of Labor, two of the primary witnesses to the charges that he belonged or had worked with his construction company with the mob were murdered. Edwin Wilson was arrested in Switzerland with $18 million in his pocket. Edwin Wilson worked with George Bush and Orlando Letelier and was familiar with the murder of, he didn't work with Letelier, he was familiar with the murder of Letelier and worked with Task Force 157, CIA and Navy Intelligence. This was the week, just following the June week, the first week of July, the murder of the President of Dominican Republic, Mr. Guzman. And that was the week that Belushi was murdered and tied into the cocaine traffic in L.A. and John Hinckley was declared not guilty. And there were so many people meeting in Switzerland, meeting in London, traveling, and Reagan running back to Dallas. The traffic and the deaths and the arrests were going on. And then about that was the week of the breaking of the large drug traffic in Pakistan that is still the headquarters of 90% of the drugs coming into New York City. And then at the time, just in those weeks, Edwin Meese's son was killed. Meese was out of town, his wife was out of town, and the kid wrapped himself around a tree in Washington, D.C. He was home from Princeton. And at the time, there's no way to prove it, but with the configuration, it was also the time when Vicky Morgan was revealing the scandals of Alfred Bloomingdale. Bloomingdale died July the 9th. She was asking for money, breaking up the story. Bloomingdale was tied to Bernie Kornfield and the Mafia and the CIA. And all of these various events, I have a calendar here of what was going on. And I felt that there was some relationship, and no way to prove, that the way the Meese story went, the way his son died, that it looked like a debt owed to the mob. That was my impression. It's nothing that I would put on the air then, but I had notes that it seemed a horrendous time, and with all the other activity going on, it's something you don't talk about or just throw out on the air. But it turns out that Daddy in June of 82 owed his $483,000. Now he's earning a salary in Washington. He's the advisor to the president. Now the president wants him to be the attorney general. How do you accumulate a debt of that size? You can't just keep buying homes. You sell one home and you get another. I've sold homes and moved. I sold a home in L.A. and moved up to Carmel. I sold a home in Carmel and moved to another home. You just don't keep those homes down with those huge mortgages. Something is behind the Meese story. And because of Reagan's links to the mob, and see, Meese shouldn't be attorney general for all the reasons of what went on at Alameda, and I can do endless broadcasts about that. But this may be your chance to write to your congressman and write to congressional committees and find out. We have a right to know, if he's the attorney general, who put every dollar into the dummy front committees that Ronald Reagan had going since 1977, ready to run for president, and who put the money into Meese. And let's not duplicate the Watergate scandal. Let's get them out, because this country just won't go into the details it did before. There's a lot to catch them on and a lot of murders that they have been doing and been behind. But the Meese story is a big story. The timing of it, the size of the debts, and the very suggestion that the debts may keep him from being the attorney general. In other words, whoever's writing these stories for the New York Times knows that there's something less than legitimate. A person can work up some kind of a debt, but the two of the people, one man who helped him, several of them got government appointments by Ronald Reagan, and the other one is one of the large fundraisers for Reagan. Everywhere around Reagan, there are scandals. Now, getting on to another subject and leaving Meese behind at least for 1 week, there are three things going on now that I just briefly want to touch on in terms of what is the Nazi Odessa? How does it affect us? How are people touched by it? How does it affect your lives? If you haven't felt it yet, you will soon. But what is it doing for people out there at large? The first matter has to do with a woman who was here in Carmel several years ago, Gabrielle Weber. Some of you know that I've talked about her on the air, W-B-E-R. She is from Germany. She came over here to do a story on Jonestown. And when she got home, she was really harassed by a fellow who was with an alleged researcher giving her a hard time. He wanted to give me a hard time. There were only two people in Berlin doing a story on Jonestown. One was suppressing it, working by way across the continent with Charles Gary. And the other was Gabrielle, and she wrote a book on Jonestown. And she wrote about the MK Ultra and the mind control programs and went into quite a bit of detail. She wrote to me this week and sent me a letter from Berlin. And she's been active over there with the Amnesty International, trying to expose the tortures, Central and South America particularly. And she was the person that turned me on to Colonial Dignitat and a lot that was going on down there. She said, "May I send you a statement of a professional organization of journalists about what has happened to me after I published the CIA Jonestown story? If you see any possibility to help me in this case, I would appreciate it. So get your pencils." Again, I'll give you this information. You write the names. She sent me a translation of the letter. It's from the Deutsche Journalist Union Berlin, called the DJU, represents the journalists in Berlin. The case, this is the case. The DJU is protesting against the withdrawal of the U.S. entry visa of our colleague, Gabrielle Weber. She has a doctor's degree, by the American Consul General in Berlin, Robert O. Blucher, B-L-U-C-H-E-R. I looked it up in Who's Who in the CIA. If any of you can write to your congressman or anybody and get the background on Robert O. Blucher, I would appreciate it. He is our American Consul in Berlin. On her account, the grounds given about taking her passport away was her activities in the early 70s with a political group, as well as a series of critical journalistic reports. She has worked for Stern and for a radio station in Berlin, SFB. After it became known to us that the decision is irreversible, that she can never enter the United States again, we were advised that Mrs. Weber should apply for a normal short-time visa. And this, too, was refused by Blucher. I don't know if any of you ever heard The Council, the opera, The Council by Menotti. I saw it in New York maybe in 1950 and bought the album. And he has beautiful work, and it's about trying to get out of Germany. The decision is irreversible. She can't come to New York or United States anymore unless we do something. The letter says, in three previous cases known to us, only when we had speedy intervention by other American departments were we able to prevent Blucher's refusal to grant visas. In this respect, the case of the SPD politician Johanna Strasser, to whom Blucher refused even a visa for an intermediate plane landing in the United States, should be remembered. The latter case made the Berlin Consulate General known in Bonn to for their harsh and selective practices. The Berlin executive has requested the decision be reversed by the Consul General. The letter states, "I see no reason why the right of free movement for journalists should not in future be afforded to Mrs. Weber also in your country. I would draw your attention to the fact that according to our laws in Germany, no American journalist, however critical, is prevented from working and moving freely. As a professional organization, we defend at all times the basic right of journalists, including foreign ones, to report unrestrictedly. The approaches of a member of the Bundestag were also fruitless. When he asked Blucher's decision be reviewed, the Germans asked him to review it on the grounds upon which it seemed incomprehensible. In a letter to the American ambassador in Bonn, Arthur Burns," and you may want to write there, "Mrs. Weber pointed out that her activities in political activities ended 10 years ago and that she had not taken part in anti-American campaigns, that her journalistic reports were based on facts already published in the United States. She went to see Joe Holsinger and she went to see me and she saw some other people and I gave her a lot of work on the mind control programs and she wrote this book in German over there." The letter goes on, "Blucher's questionable method of proceeding in this matter is notable. After her withdrawal of the long-term visa, whereby she had not come to the United States again, Blucher requested that Mrs. Weber, Gabrielle, bring her passport to the consulate for the visa to be stamped invalid, her passport invalid, you can't go. When she refused, pointing out that the passport was the property of the German authorities and not the American consulate, and that in any case she wished to make efforts to have it revised, he threatened by letter to inform every airline company to take precautions to prevent her being transported to the United States. An American consulate wants to take the passport away of a German rider to come to this country because she wrote about Jonestown. She sought to obtain a temporary U.S. visa when he refused, and she was accompanied to the consulate by a member from the Berlin executive of the journalist, who was refused admittance to them on the instruction of Blücher. And in the meantime, Mrs. Weber possessed a new passport in which she wanted a temporary visa to be stamped. Instead of this, they put a small stamp stating that she had applied for a visa. This was an indication that the possessor of the passport has applied for entry and has been refused. In other words, she has applied. And they put a small stamp there, which is the decision of the states friendly to the United States considering whether or not to give a visa. So Gabrielle Weber cannot come to this United States unless we do something, and she can't come temporarily. She can come never. It is a German visa. It is an American at the embassy there who, because of her Jonestown article and also with her work with Amnesty International, I'm sure, and exposing mind control, and I told you mind control is as important as the atomic bomb. She cannot come to this country. Now, another person, a victim of unfairness, of course, is Larry Flint. He called this week from Durham, South Carolina. How would you like to be in a federal prison in Strom Thurmond territory? It's horrendous. He doesn't seem to be too dissatisfied. He thinks he'll be flown to California soon, but for what is he sitting there 15 months in a federal penitentiary in a where they have mind control programs and can alter food or whatever you have? He is a victim of a harsh sentence after being victimized in other forms that we've talked about down there now in Durham, South Carolina, away from California where his friends can see him or visit him or see his mental state or know what's going on. He's far out of sight, and he couldn't be in a worse place unless it was North Carolina. And then finally, there's Johnny Meyer, who I talked about on programs before, who's been extradited from Canada down to LAPD. His trial will begin soon. I'm trying in whatever ways I can to help Johnny. I tried to give him information. When he was charged with the murder of Mr. Netter, a man that died November 29, 1974, a stabbing at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. Johnny Meyer was in Canada. The people that stabbed him are not even sought. They're away, and because of financial dealings of John getting a loan for this particular company, the Transcontinental Video, and the company having this loan, and they insured it on Netter's life, he is charged with the murder. The LAPD want to get him. Johnny Meyer worked for the Hughes Organization from 1966 up through Watergate to 72. When Watergate story broke, he went to George McGovern and the Democrats and tried to tell him about the Howard Hughes Organization and the funding of Nixon under the table. The Democrats wouldn't use his information, and Nixon won the reelection, and then they were out after Johnny. And ever since then, he has spent time in and out of jails, and the Beverly Hills and Los Angeles police are out to get him. I told him 2 years ago to use an offense for his defense and link the Beverly Hills police, which is all documented, to Howard Hughes, to G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, and the LAPD and the Beverly Police, and show how the Beverly police system that is prosecuting him was involved in drugging Howard Hughes and shipping him to a Boston hospital, and that he worked for the Hughes Organization, and that these people are out to get him because he was exposing those scandals. And he did have in the newspapers at a press conference up in Canada that Hughes, Howard didn't live. And if he didn't live after 1966, or at least wasn't seen and didn't live after 1971, he would blow open all the shenanigans these people are pulling. Now, I said to him why, for 2 years, I offered to help and do something. He said the reason he didn't use what I had is he never believed that they'd have been on a murder charge, just like Nazi Germany. That's what the Odessa is, putting people like Larry Flint, who can have his own home, his own comfort, his own physical therapy and dietitian. He's already been shot and paralyzed. Instead of treating him like a person who has opinions of the government that he's trying to expose and instead of treating like a person who has to be punished. That's what they're doing. They're punishing him. And incidentally, I was doing research, a little more research, into Mr. Singlaub, S-I-N-G-L-A-U-B, because of an article that Jack Anderson had this week about the Nazis and the fascists out of Taiwan and the World Anti-Communist League. Singlaub, the current president of the World Anti-Communist League that runs from Taiwan to South America to Reverend Moon and all over to the most conservative groups in the United States, that I wrote about both in the Rebel and in the article on the Korean airline. Mr. Singlaub is on the board of Western Goals, and I pulled out of my files material people had sent me of him sitting with Mitchell Werbel and Mr. Brown, who's later down at Grenada. Werbel moves right into Larry Flynt's home. Larry may say he's a friend. The man's gone, thank goodness. But Werbel was close always to Mr. Singlaub, who formed the Rangers. And I'll do more next week. It looks like I don't have time. Singlaub was the person who put together the original Rangers while the Nazis were putting together the Green Beret. Singlaub is on the board of Western Goals with the other Nazis and member of the Luftwaffe and Mr. Wigner from the BND and the Germans. And they feed the information of our anti-war petitions into their computers and send it over to Germany and around the world. So in doing work on Singlaub and the World Anti-Communist League and tying it into past articles I've done, and as currently being the president, there he is sitting with Mr. Mitchell Werbel. And as soon as Larry Flynt is talking about the Western Goals organization and the Los Angeles Police Department and publishing that, Mr. Werbel, who works with Singlaub represents not only the World Anti-Communist League, but Western Goals is on the board of Western Goals with Roy Cohn, the attorney for Mr. Bloomingdale, and it goes on and on. I mean, the group of names that you can throw together, say, from South America, from Germany, from Asia, keep reappearing over and over again now. They're all coming together very nicely, and the research is getting, it was always solid, but every new day, new names come in. So when Werbel is sitting with Singlaub of Western Goals, then Larry talks about Western Goals and Singlaub moves into, Werbel moves into Larry's house. That's the pecking order. That's the way it was done. And no matter how he swears, he was his friend. I told you over and over on the air that he was not. So how can Larry Flynt write in Rebel about the World Anti-Communist League and at the same time entertain Mr. Mitchell Werbel, who is such a close associate of Mr. Singlaub? Singlaub was fired by Jimmy Carter for insubordination, but he runs these organizations. Now, we have about 6 minutes, and I want to update you on a broadcast I did. This was 2 weeks ago, February the 6th, broadcast number 635. An article that was sent to me from the New Republic, Watergate on the Rhine, Der Scandal. It was about Herr Friedrich Karl Flick and the scandal of the money in Germany, the millions of dollars that have been put into politicians. Was it 500 million? The court case is pretty quiet there. And the chairman of Friedrich Flick's group, Eberhard von Broschwitz, who works with J. Peter Grace and Otto Ambrose, and is on the board, Eberhard von Broschwitz, the nephew of Adolf Hitler's commander-in-chief. They're all working together now. They're involved in the scandals in Germany, the political hundreds of millions coming to the United States, the J. Peter Grace, out of Germany. Well, right after I had that broadcast, David Emery very quickly went to one of our favorite books, The Nazis Go Underground, and he took out the material about Mr. von Broschwitz's uncle, the one who was Hitler's general. And the chapter is called Generals Never Give Up, and it tells about Heinrich Himmler and Martin Bormann and Field Marshal Werner von Broschwitz, the high commander of the German army, who October 15th, 1941, realized that Adolf Hitler couldn't take the Soviet Union. Von Broschwitz left most of the Nazis, made their organizations by 1943, taking those hundreds of millions and putting them in Swiss banks and out of the country. But von Broschwitz served in World War I and remembered the cold winters and realized that if Hitler couldn't take the Soviet Union within a certain time stance, that he never could take them, that the Third Reich had lost that war. So along with von Rundstedt and other commanders and chiefs, he began surviving so that Germany wouldn't lose. He knew the war there was lost for Germany, but according to this book, he had every intention of surviving it himself. Now, it says he wanted to build up the German army and get ready. Well, Mr. Friedrich Flick's father was the one who funded Himmler and the SS, funded Adolf Hitler, had the steelworks. Otto Ambrose was working, designing the Zyklon B and the poison gases for Auschwitz, for the extermination in Treblinka and the mass exterminations. And Braun Vonswitsch was officially working with the top generals so that the bankers, the generals, IG Farb and the chemical compounds and so forth were working, starting several years before they knew the war was lost. Now, a similar parallel is taking place right now, which I'm going to include in my Grenada story, that has to do with Singlaub and the Rangers and the Special Forces. And that is the role of Singlaub in Asia during the Vietnam War, after the Korean. He was involved in all of those with Colonel Charles Willoughby and Douglas MacArthur, the Korean part. Vietnam was a spectator where he sat there and watched and wrote his script of what to do the next time. All of these little coups that Friedrich Schwinn was in, the Dominican Republic, the attempt, the Bay of Pigs, the various coups, military dictatorships that have been put in, are test case, all of them, for the big one against the Soviet Union. They don't lose anything necessarily if they lose the little war, and the one thing they get is the anger of the people for having lost it. So on the one hand, if you win, if you take Czechoslovakia and Romania and Poland and France and all of Europe, it's a victory. If you don't take Russia, you start again. And then the people that lost it are more anxious to help again. Just like after the Versailles Treaty, the Germans were all anxious to make World War II, and there wasn't any hesitancy in rearming. Or after the Bay of Pigs, they were anxious to kill John Kennedy and get on with taking other countries in Central and South America or Asia. So the book, The Nazi Goes Underground, tells about the work that they did and their work with army intelligence and fascist organizations and how they all consistently worked. And then, as I say, the nephew of the man, the general, who was in on the plans to rearm and get ready for the next war, the Fourth Reich, that may be successful in his mind, and the son of Flick, who's involved with putting hundreds of millions into the United States as a partner with J. Peter Grace, they are still working. The nephew, the son, the book Nazis Go Underground tells about the departments that they worked with and what they set up and how they planned to work. They had people setting up the network, he tells, worked for the light, water, and electricity companies, the utilities, be where you're needed. That's why the Georgia Power and Light Company was part of the Alfred Bloomingdale organization. And John Reese and Jerry Ducote and the Reagan spy system in the United States working the utilities. They also know the bills when you turn utilities off or where you move. So they got jobs in this country and in Europe with mail, electricity, gas, and water. And so the hierarchy stayed directly in the family, just as Otto Skorzeny married Hallmar Schacht's daughter. He's a son-in-law of the banker of the Reich Bank. Well, we can't do any more on the Nazis Go Underground, but just to update the story from the New Republic, it's important to know that the same people that planned to go underground that were written in the book are in today's newspaper, today's scandals, and guess what they're doing? They're funding politicians to put in more of their same kind and making sure they win the election so that they can be voted in again, just as Hitler was voted in 1933. Well, now you have a little homework to do. You can write to those people about Gabrielle Weber and write to your congressman about Larry Flint and let him know how you feel. How you feel about the imprisonment, or Johnny Meyer. You can keep busy writing letters all week. I appreciate that. I don't know if you will, but it'd be nice if you do. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel. I'll be back with you next week. This is KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.